When we ended yesterday, I had tried to do a little bit of introductory work on the opening chapters, and there were a couple of things that we noticed already. One was that first of all, Lewis is trying to confront us with the choice dimension of human existence, and that's the basis for the title of the book, The Great Divorce, namely that all things do not turn into good in the end, that somewhere along the way we must make choices. And as he tries to present the alternative between good and evil, he makes the point that evil is more like illusion, which does not mean that it does not have either reality or power. That is, it exists and it exerts power, but the kind of power that it exerts is the power of, in a sense, believing a lie or believing something which is deceptive. I didn't mention this yesterday, but I would like to. A person whom I have found very perceptive in this area is Stanley Hauerwas, who teaches ethics at Notre Dame. And I think we have a book of his in the bookstore called Truthfulness and Tragedy. And one of the essays in that book is an essay that Hauerwas wrote called Autobiography and Self-Deception. And it's reflections on Albert Speer's autobiography, not because Speer's autobiography is full of self-deception, but because in Hauerwas's judgment, Speer's autobiography is that rare exception in autobiographies where Speer is ruthlessly honest with himself. And when I first read, I think it's called Inside the Third Reich, I wondered too, and I marveled at Speer's scrupulous honesty, especially when he asks himself the question if he had known the consequences of the Nazi movement when he became involved in it early in the 30s, would he have continued in it? And he said, painfully, as he tried to find alternatives, he felt his values were such that he would have gone along with it anyway, even had he known. He excused himself not at all. And later on, when I read Speer's book, The Spandau Diaries, I discovered an important thing. I kept wondering, where does a man get that kind of courage? Because he hardly ever exhibits any Christian reflection in his book, Inside the Third Reich. And in the Spandau Diaries, he finally talks about how a French chaplain by the name of Georges Cassalis had been feeding him a fairly steady diet of Karl Barth's writings while he was in prison. And it was in those writings that Speer began to discover both something of the Christian gospel and then something of the courage to make a confession. And it was a dimension that isn't present at all in Inside the Third Reich. But Hauerwas's main point is that we spin out stories of self-deception, that the first object of our lying is not someone else, but ourselves, that we really do believe the stories we fabricate about ourselves. In the end, we are the victims of our own monumental capacity for self-deception. Well, Lewis is, in a sense, trying to illustrate that. He talks about hell as a place where anything can be had for the imagining, except that it isn't finally worth having. That we build imaginary houses to live in, except that for purposes of protection, defense of ourselves, except that in the end, they do not really defend. Well, now, what he does then is not just talk about this in a sort of theoretical way, but he illustrates it in episode after episode in The Great Divorce. And we're going to see if hell is illusion, the other thing I wanted to say, heaven then is for Lewis the epitome of reality. It is more real than one can possibly imagine. It is in fact almost a qualitatively different kind of reality. And we'll see what he does as he plays with this imagery in his journey. The interesting thing is, of course, that it appears to us as if heaven is in fact the mirage, the illusion, the wish dream with which we comfort ourselves while we are here. Lewis just sort of turns this on its head. Hell seems to be made up at least of the tangible and the real, the thing you can put your finger on. Lewis says, but it is precisely the reverse. The reverse is actually the case. It's an interesting tour de force. Well, now he has, after he has described the light and the hardness of the reality of this marvelous country to which he has come, and as he has alerted us to the range of mountains ahead, far away on the bottom of page 29, I could see what might be either a great bank of cloud or a range of mountains. Sometimes I could make out in its steep forests, far withdrawing valleys, and even mountain cities perched on inaccessible summits. At other times it became indistinct. The height was so enormous that my waking sight could not have taken in such an object at all. Light brooded on the top of it, slanting down thence it made long shadows behind every tree on the plain. There was no change, no progression as the hours passed. The promise or the threat of sunrise rested immovably up there. And now he begins to see a new set of characters that emerge from the stage. Remember the bus driver. Everybody responded very negatively to the bus driver when he first appeared, and Lewis has all these comments about the people quoting the comments. Now we are introduced to some characters like the bus driver. Long after that, I saw people coming to meet us. Because they were bright, I saw them while they were still very distant, and at first I did not know that they were people at all. Mile after mile they drew nearer. The earth shook under their tread as their strong feet sank into the wet turf. A tiny haze and a sweet smell went up where they had crushed the grass and scattered the dew. Some were naked, some robed, but the naked ones did not seem less adorned, and the robes did not disguise in those who wore them the massive grandeur of muscle and the radiant smoothness of flesh. One interesting observation in the Genesis story, clothing is, the fig leaves are protection for people whose vulnerability has suddenly become a burden to them. Because they know in the moment of their nakedness that they are vulnerable, and they know above all, because they know themselves, what the other can do to them. Adam was already prepared to say, do it to Eve, you see. She's the one who got us into this mess. And in that moment, when you know that you will turn on someone else in an effort to save yourself, you are suddenly aware of your own vulnerability. And that is, in the last analysis, the meaning of the fig leaves. Again, an attempt to protect ourselves when we are really not protectable. But these people, you see, clothing no longer matters. That's the point he's trying to make here. Some were bearded, but no one of that company struck me as being of any particular age. I'm glad one was bearded, at least. One gets glimpses, even in our country, of that which is ageless. Heavy thought in the face of an infant and frolic childhood in that of a very old man. Here it was all like that. They came on steadily. I did not entirely like it. Two of the ghosts screamed and ran for the bus. The rest of us huddled closer to one another. And now, as the solid people came nearer, still I noticed that they were moving with order and determination, as though each of them had marked his man in our shadowy company. I wish Lewis would, well, you can't rewrite this, but I wish Lewis had said, mark their persons, or some less male designation. There are going to be affecting scenes, I said to myself. Perhaps it would not be right to look on. And with that I sidled away in some vague pretext of doing a little exploring. A grove of huge cedars to my right seemed attractive, and I entered it. Walking proved difficult. The grass, hard as diamonds to my unsubstantial feet, made me feel as if I were walking on wrinkled rock, and I suffered pains like those of the mermaid in Hans Andersen. A bird ran across in front of me, and I envied it. It belonged to that country, and was as real as the grass. It could bend the stalks and spatter itself with dew. One of the points Lewis is making here is that the people who live with illusion find reality painful, dreadfully painful. And so with his own transparency, because he could be seen through, he has difficulty dealing with reality. When someone asks you, tell me the truth, you have to make sure how many illusions they are really hooked on, because the truth is going to be terribly painful for them. There are others who, when they say, tell me the truth, want it, and you know they want it, and you don't have to pull any punches. Almost at once I was followed by what I would have called the big man, to speak more accurately, the big ghost. He in his turn was followed by one of the bright people. And the bright person shouted, don't you know me, to the ghost, and I found it impossible not to attend. I found it, the face of the solid spirit, he was one of those that wore a robe, made me want to dance. It was, you know, one of the things that Lewis is trying to describe for us here is a person who invites the experience of the truth, I guess, whose joy in the truth is evident already in his appearance. I wonder if we could read this as a dialogue. Stephen, you have a copy there. Do you want to read the part of the ghost? Just leave out the said the ghost and stuff, and I'll play the bright spirit. Before we do that, just let me call your attention to the, you're the straight man, I'll have all the good lines. let me just call your attention, among other things, to Lewis's use of language here, and above all, to double entendre. I don't mean sexual double entendre at this point, but to the double meanings along the way. Oh, bleeding, charity, and bloody. In medieval England, to swear by the blood of Christ in the sacrament was one of the holiest things you could swear by. So that bloody then became a kind of all-purpose adjective, the way goddamn is for Americans. And Lewis now turns this use of language so that we see it both as thoughtless, you know, it's just it's a sort of poverty of adjectives and expletives, and yet at the same time, what if it really meant that? And he starts right off with that, Stefan. You've got the first line, huh?
Well, I'm damned. I wouldn't have believed it. It's a fair knockout. It isn't right, Len, you know. What about poor Jack, eh? You look pretty pleased with yourself, but what I say is, what about poor Jack?
Oh, he is here. You will meet him soon if you stay.
But you murdered him.
Of course I did. It's all right now.
All right, is it? All right for you, you mean. But what about the poor chap himself, laying cold and dead?
But he isn't. I've told you, you will meet him soon. He sent you his love.
What I'd like to understand is what you're here for. As pleased as Punch, you, a bloody murderer, while I've been walking the streets down there and living in a place like a pigsty all these years.
Oh, that is a little hard to understand at first, but it's all over now. You will be pleased about it presently. Till then, there is no need to bother about it.
No need to bother about it? Aren't you ashamed of yourself?
Oh, no, not as you mean. I don't look at myself. I have given up myself. I had to, you know, after the murder, double entendre. That's what it was. That was what it did for me, and that was how everything began.
Personally, I'd have thought you and I ought to be the other way around. That's my personal opinion.
Very likely we soon shall be, if you'll stop thinking about it.
Look at me now. I've gone straight all my life. I don't say I was a religious man, and I don't say I had no faults, far from it. But I've done my best all my life, see? I've done my best by everyone. That's
yes.
The sort of chap I was.
Let me just comment here for a moment that precisely when somebody starts by saying, I don't say I had no faults, what you're going to get at that point is really a statement, if I've done my best, how can you blame me for anything? Notice the contradiction. Okay, go on.
Let's see. I've done my best by everyone. That's the sort of chap I was. I never asked for anything that wasn't mine by rights. If I wanted a drink, I paid for it. And if I took my wages, I'd done my job. See? That's the sort I was, and I don't care who knows it.
Oh, it would be much better not to go on about that now.
Who's going on? I'm not arguing. I'm just telling you the sort of chap I was. I'm asking for nothing but my rights. You may think you can put me down because you dressed up like that, which you weren't when you worked under me. And I'm only a poor man. But I got to have my rights, same as you.
Oh, no, it's not so bad as that. I haven't got my rights or I should not be here. And you won't get yours either. You'll get something far better, never fear.
That's just what I say. I haven't got my rights. I've always done my best and I've never done nothing wrong. And what I don't see is why I should be put below a bloody murderer like you.
Who knows whether you will be? Only be happy and come with me.
What do you keep on arguing for? I'm only telling you the sort of chap I am. I only want my rights. I'm not asking for anybody's bleeding charity.
Then do, at once, ask for the bleeding charity. Everything here is for the asking. Nothing can be bought.
That may be very well for you, I dare say. They choose to let in a bloody murderer all because he makes a poor mouth at the last moment. That's their lookout. But I don't see myself going in the same boat with you, see? Why should I? I don't want charity. I'm a decent man, and if I had my rights, I'd have been here long ago, and you can tell them I said so.
You can never do it like that. Your feet will never grow hard enough to walk on our grass that way. You'd be tired out before we got to the mountains. And it isn't exactly true, you know.
What isn't true?
You weren't a decent man, and you didn't do your best. None of us were, and none of us did. Lord bless you, it doesn't matter. There is no need to go into all that now.
You have the face to tell me I wasn't a decent chap.
Of course. Must I go into all that? I will tell you one thing to begin with. Murdering old Jack wasn't the worst thing I did. That was the work of a moment, and I was half mad when I did it. But I murdered you in my heart deliberately for years. I used to lie awake nights thinking what I'd do to you if I ever got the chance. That's why I've been sent to you now, to ask your forgiveness and to be your servant as long as you need one, and longer if it pleases you. I was the worst, but all the men who worked under you felt the same. You made it hard for us, you know. You made it hard for your wife, too, and for your children.
You mind your own business, young man. None of your lips, see? Because I'm not taking any impudence from you about my private affairs.
There are no private affairs.
And I'll tell you another thing. You can clear off, see? You're not wanted. I may be only a poor man, but I'm not making pals with a murderer, let alone taking lessons from him. Made it hard for you in your life, did I? If I had you back there, I'd show you what work is.
Oh, come and show me now. It will be joy going to the mountains, but there will be plenty of work.
You don't suppose I'd go with you?
Don't refuse. You will never get there alone. And I'm the one who was sent to you.
So that's the trick, is it? I thought there'd be some damn nonsense. It's all a click. All a bloody click. Tell them I'm not coming, see? I'd rather be damned than go along with you. I came here to get my rights, see? Not to go snivelling along on a charity tied onto your apron strings. If they're too fine to have me without you, I'll go home. That's what I'll do. I'll go home. I didn't come here to be treated like a dog. I'll go home. That's what I'll do. Damn and blast the whole pack of you.
And in the end, still grumbling, but whimpering also a little as it picked its way over the sharp grasses it made off. What do you sense as the key notion here in this whole dialogue? Let's take some time to talk about it. Anybody? What seemed to be the key notion to you? Go ahead.
One thing I picked out was that it seemed like they were both put on equal basis. Okay, the one guy is the murderer, and the other guy's complaining that you murdered somebody, you're worse off than I am. But at the end, it doesn't come out that way.
But it's equality based on grace rather than justice.
Yeah.
Or maybe you couldn't have equality in that situation unless it was based on grace rather than justice.
Is the bright spirit actually equal? Do we know that? Mm-hmm. Or is there a kind of leveling here? Yes, he says it doesn't matter, and he says we don't even know yet where everybody is going to end up on what kind of a scale, and it really doesn't matter.
It's almost like they're going to be judged on some other basis.
Yes, precisely.
I didn't read it yet.
Well, no, but this is the episode. This is it, complete. We know everything we're ever going to know about this particular conversation. Nothing else is going to be said. All right, please.
What I saw coming through is this tremendous human desire to justify oneself, mm-hmm. even to the point of, in effect, damning oneself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the hanging on to the ego to the point that all that matters is destroyed. You know, he'll still have his justice and he'll still have all the rules on his side.
Lewis had said at one point that he says, if we insist on keeping hell, we shall not see heaven. If we accept heaven, we shall not be able to retain even the smallest and most intimate souvenirs of hell. I believe to be sure that any man who reaches heaven will find that what he abandoned was precisely nothing, that the kernel of what he was really seeking, even in his most depraved wishes, will be there beyond expectation. We're getting assaulted from both sides. Do you hear him over and over again saying something about charity? Did you remember that, or anybody?
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that? What does he say, first of all?
He says, ask for the bleeding charity.
Yes? In response to what? To what kind of a comment?
To the guy saying, I'm not asking for bloody
charity. Right. And there are several other places where he says that. Look at that for a moment. His insistence on his rights goes with the notion that he doesn't want charity, and at the very end he says, I came here to get my rights, not to go sniveling along on charity tied onto your apron strings. How do you assess that? How do you understand that?
I think it has to do with man's independence, and you have to work to get everything that you get, and you don't like to take handouts from other people. And it's kind of to me like grace, like you'd rather work for your own salvation than take it. It's too easy to take it. You need to do something.
Well, there's strings attached anytime you receive something. There's lots of times, you know, nothing is free, in other words.
It's not unlike the promising worker.
Yeah.
You have to say that he's dependent on anybody else or anything else. Opens up. It makes me vulnerable, as you said. That same way. Somewhere he's not in charge. Here, you know, he has to control things.
Can I ask, how do you feel about gifts of almost anything? You're embarrassed? Why?
Because I don't think I'm worth the gift.
You don't think you're worth the gift. I see. All right.
I like gifts because if I know the person, then it's an expression. It's an expression. It's not simply just a gift that would embarrass me. But it's a sign or a communication of some sort of love or something like that.
What kind of gifts are you talking about, Steph?
Someone giving a birthday present, someone taking you out to dinner, the gifts of understanding, things like that too. Those are gifts.
How would you feel about being on welfare?
Yeah, that's true. I think it'd be feel like it. I was thinking of personal gifts.
I have to respond to what I work in right now. And many of the people that I have dealt with, some of them, like our friend who thinks it's right, and the others are bashful and all get out and don't really want to be there. They're boring, they're voiced about. And I have to tell them, it's your right, go ahead, we'll see what. They just don't want, the ones that really don't want the gift, really don't want the gift. We're saying to them, you have to take food stamps, which isn't true. But it's that kind of, but like, I was even feeling last night when I went to, I was sitting back there and I was trying to say, okay, it's enough, I've heard the words, right? I don't need to go out and, because as Walt knows, it was a little complicated. I don't need to go out there, right? You know, I don't need to be a pain in somebody's rear end. I don't need to cause problems. But yet, the gift called me on. It said, come, regardless of what happens, come. And I think that needs to be our attitude.
I have a cousin who cannot accept any kind of gift, whether it's physical or emotional. You know, why don't you sit down and let me do the dishes? Although she insists on spending her whole life waiting on other people, she cannot relax ever and let somebody give to her. And she ends up annoying more people than all the giving that she does. You know, all that much giving that she does is really a neat thing. But because she doesn't know how to receive, often wondered why that is, why we can't accept what she gives and why we feel like we have to give her something else. And she won't accept it. It's awful.
2 years ago, when we were, when John and I were sitting down, first of all, and thinking about the Holden Summer program, after John had become director, we had a letter from Larry Collins about faculty here. And in his letter to us, he said that when he had first come here on faculty, he was terribly filled with anxiety to sort of earn his being here and just insisted on doing sessions all the time. And so he wrote to us that we should, by all means, as we were inviting new faculty to come to the village, tell them that Holden was literally a gift to the churches, and that it is a gift to the people who are up here, even a gift to the people who have to stop by the registration desk before they leave. That's one of my experience has been that mostly that's the hardest thing I have to work at. That faculty want to make sure they are sort of earning their way by doing enough sessions. I felt the same way when I was here on faculty. I wanted to make absolutely sure that I was pulling my weight. I wasn't going to have this place be a gift for me at all. I don't know what happened in your orientation sessions, but in the one that I had, Mary spent a lot of time talking about Holden as a community that was gift from beginning to end. But it's very, very difficult for those of us who have been accustomed to taking our paychecks on the basis of the job we did, literally to live with gift. I guess I don't know in the last analysis what that means as far as religion is concerned. Most of the people that I've been associated with in the churches from my boyhood on have been people who have made their own way and who have everything they have by right. I mean by legal and moral rectitude. I don't mean I don't mean that even they were hard taskmasters. They were just farmers who worked hard. They were businessmen, small businessmen mostly, who also worked hard, who tried to give fair value, or professional and working people who made sure that they earned their money honestly. And then I say to myself, but these are the people who have populated the churches, who have been sitting Sunday after Sunday in the pews, and Christianity somehow doesn't function that way at all. We are all of us on this planet by grace. We didn't choose to be here. We didn't ask to be here. We didn't deserve a place somehow in the whole scheme of things. But that's precisely what the gospel wants to somehow be saying to us. Life itself is a gift, and we simply don't act that way. What in the world is happening now?
Some child. The kids are up there.
The what?
The kids are up there.
Oh, what is?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, I feel that most people who have difficulty receiving gifts, and I have been in that position and still kind of am,
mm-hmm.
that you don't feel worthy. And I have an aunt who is... described her. You give her a gift at Christmas time. She's very well to do, and she won't even wrap it. And finally, the last Christmas we had that way, I sat there and I said, "You're going to unwrap the gifts that we have given you." And I sat there until she did. In fact, I offered to do it for her, and then she got with it. You know, but she just feels that she has to do the giving. And I think it comes from a deep sense of being unworthy. Because we have both things going on in our lives,
Yes, two of you have now mentioned the notion of unworthiness. Is that the only dynamic at work in this whole business of gift, please?
I think that a lot of times we don't want to accept gifts because of our pride. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think that comes into a lot with God, in that we don't want to accept what He has to give us because maybe we still want to do it on our own. And I sure know the feeling, because I'm the kind of person who likes to be on the giving end instead of the receiving end. And somehow, when you're receiving a gift, it's because there's nothing that you have done that merits that you can receive that gift. And so it's strictly on the basis of the other person's giving. And it has nothing to do with your... It's not something you can use to bolster your pride, kind of a gift, and that's the way I see it with him. I'm reminded of the parable of the laborers in the field and the vineyards, when he talks about this, and how he says that here's a murderer went and confessed on his deathbed or whatever it was and turned to the Lord, and yet here he was in heaven, and this other guy who was such a good guy all his life was... working hard all the time. He was there the whole 12 hours. Yet he kind of got the same due as the other guy. Well, he got the bad end of the deal. Didn't get paid as much or whatever.
Can it be the reason that somebody who just keeps chugging along every day, supposedly doing his duty, and would not get the reward one would expect, could it be because of the lack of trust? And maybe that's part of what gift giving. You don't want to get used to getting things that you can't earn yourself. You don't, you know you can't count on them, or you don't feel like you can. You know, if you just relax and see what comes your way, how many people are willing to trust that, even though we're told in places in the Bible that we could do that anytime we wanted to, and it would happen, and we would be okay. I don't think very many Americans, I don't know really too much about other cultures, but Americans do have the Protestant work ethic. And I don't think we just trust that things have come along and take care of it. So maybe that's part of it. We don't want to get in the habit of expecting something to come when we don't honestly believe that it will.
If Lewis is talking here about something that must be given up, well, let me back up just one moment. One of the things I haven't heard so far is the notion that to receive a gift puts you under obligation. That's the point at which I guess I'm embarrassed. Not so, I can understand people feeling unworthy. There are times, I guess, when I've been given things that I really felt sort of unworthy about. But mostly, I don't want to be under obligation. I feel much more comfortable if I'm obligating people than if I'm under obligation, which is precisely why.
Which isn't very nice, because you're putting them in.
You're right, you're right. Oh, I know. I'm not trying to say, well, that's a good way to go. I'm just trying to say, I feel better when I can obligate people.
Yeah. But wait, are you really obligating them? I mean, when I receive a gift, I may feel under obligation. But when I give one, I don't feel like I have obligated that person. Are you, I mean, do you consciously or semi-consciously feel like, well, now they owe me one, or I, at least I'm one up on them? That's,
yes,
exactly,
yes, that was one of the, that was one of the main psychological dynamics that I experienced in myself when I was a pastor. The more I could do for less, the more under obligation people would feel to me. And it was pretty deadly. It was really deadly. It was probably almost a form of manipulating. And it was a way of literally staying one up on people. Maybe it's a peculiar affliction of the clergy. I don't know. I haven't really asked about it, because I haven't talked much about this before. This is the first time I think I've ever tried to let a conversation on this chapter go in this direction. But really, I think I consciously used to figure out what I could do for people that would somehow in the end obligate them. Not that I was ever going to collect. Oh, I was going to be too noble for that. I wanted all these IOUs out there, you see, that I was never going to call in. But I wanted everybody, in a sense, to be under obligation, and I did not want to be obligated myself. That was, in a sense, my way of securing my existence.
Could that be the long way around to unworthiness, though? The more you're one up on everybody, the more you can relax. You know, you're not hard to do anything that maybe you don't feel like you're capable of doing. In other words, if you've got it so that everybody's covered, you've done something for everybody, then you can breathe a sigh of relief and relax for a little while. Not,
yes, but what a way, you know, what a way to get, yes, of course it's possible. You do feel good at that point, and you can sort of relax, but what a way. It is not a way that takes other people all that seriously, in a sense. And it certainly is not a way of entering into partnership with them. You know, it's if it is a partnership, you're the senior partner, really.
In gift receiving, you cannot let the giver feel that you deserve the gift. Because if you end up doing that all the time, you'll end up not getting any gifts.
Right. If you feel like it's your due, kind of, you know, like, why, yeah, I thank you for that. Of course you should give it to me. You don't get any, do you?
It what fills our way, you end up getting hardly anything.
let me just sort of focus this now by saying, what about if Lewis is saying that the choice means something must be given up in order to experience the power of heaven, what does this man have to give up then? What does he really have to give up? And what is the thing he insists on keeping? Well, his independence, all right.
Self-determination.
All right. Is this a word for everybody? I mean, is this episode does it strike every last human being?
I think so.
You think everybody? Anybody who disagrees?
Not everyone has that same problem.
I think that would be in the end, everyone who has this problem needs to see himself in this episode, but not everybody will have the problem. You know, I suppose there are a lot of people who may well go through life having no problem at all accepting gifts and who have other difficulties that need to be dealt with. But at least those of us, I am particularly struck by this chapter because I am one of the I gotta have my rights types. I really do recognize myself here, and it's kind of devastating to read this. Well,
what
all right.
What does Scripture call it? The giving up?
Dying to yourself.
Yeah, what was that, Gretchen?
Romans, dying to yourself so that we can all be heirs of grace.
You're giving up the self, right?
Heirs don't earn a thing.
Yeah, or whatever it is that we have used to constitute the self. What we're really doing here is in a sense ripping down those imaginary houses that don't protect us anyway, but that we think do. And this man's house was the determination that he was never going to take charity, that he was always going to have his rights, that he was always going to pay his way. Right. One other little comment. The bright spirit who is sent to him has I think, one of the most important lines in the book. Nobody gets to the mountains alone. Nobody gets to the mountains alone. Each of us needs at least one other as a mirror, in a sense, or as someone to hold up a mirror to ourselves so that we see ourselves for what we are. And the manner in which Lewis does this, the guy does not come as the bright spirit does not come as the enemy. He no longer needs to make his own way at the expense of the man whom he has come to help. And Lewis tries to say that by saying, when he admonishes him, it's with mirth dancing in his eyes, not, aha, I've got the goods on you. But don't you see the point? I mean, all you have to do is lay aside this terrible burden of paying your own way and get a whole new mind on things. The Greek word for it is metanoia. The translation is repent. Just get a new mind on things. You don't need to be the way you are. You don't need to drag this terrible burden of always obligating others and having rights yourself. But it's admonition. And admonition is always given for the sake of the other. Accusation is when I need to get the goods on you so that I can feel superior to you. This bright spirit has given up himself, he says at one point. What he meant is he gave himself up to the police or to the courts or something, but the double entendre is there. He has given up himself, and therefore he doesn't have to be the accuser. He can instead become the admonisher. And the difference between accusation and admonition is whom you're doing it for. Accusation we do for our sakes, admonition we do for the sake of the other. And there is a very, very thin line between them, but it is a terribly important one. It makes all the difference in the world. Well, this is, I think, a sort of rich and devastating episode. Let's see if we can get another one in. In chapter 5, he has a conversation with a bishop. It may be a fairly long one, but let's see how much of it we can get read, and we can start discussing it tomorrow then. Who wants to be the bishop in this episode? Any volunteers?
This is the Episcopal Church, or the Church of England. They have lady bishops there, I assume.
No, they don't. Not in England. No.
This is where we started. Right now.
How do we know this? Okay, Gretchen, you can be the bishop. We know how he's a bishop because of the last word on the bottom of page 37. What are gaiters? Anybody know?
What do you wear when you go skiing?
Really, a pants
dry. What are they?
The boot covers that keep your pants dry and your boots.
Short leggings.
Leggings.
Yeah.
They're tall spats, yes, really, is what they are. Or, better yet, they are trousers that are buttoned all the way down. And bishops in England wear them, still with three-quarter length black coats, and these buttons going down the side, all the way down on both sides. And so you can tell the man is a bishop because he is wearing gaiters. All right. Gretchen, you have the first line on the top of 38.
My dear boy, I'm delighted to see you. This is making almost blindingly light.
Leave those parts out.
Just read the
dialogue.
I was talking to your poor father the other day and wondering where you were.
You didn't bring him?
Well, no. He lives a long way from the bus, and to be quite frank, he's been getting a little eccentric lately. A little difficult, losing his grip. He never was prepared to make any great efforts, you know. If you remember, he used to go to sleep when you and I got talking seriously. Ah, Dick, I shall never forget some of our talks. I expect you've changed your views a bit since then. You became rather narrow-minded toward the end of your life, but no doubt you've broadened out again.
How do you mean?
Well, it's obvious by now, isn't it, that you weren't quite right. Why, my dear boy, you were coming to believe in a literal heaven.
But wasn't I right?
Oh, in a spiritual sense. I still believe that in that way, I am still, my dear boy, looking for the kingdom, but nothing superstitious or mythological.
Excuse me, where do you imagine you've been?
I see. You mean that the great town with its continual hope of morning, we must all live by hope, must we not? With its field for indefinite progress is, in a sense, heaven. If only we have eyes to see it, that it is a beautiful idea.
I didn't mean that at all. Is it possible you don't know where you've been?
Now that you mention it, I don't think we ever do give it a name. What do you call it?
We call it hell.
There's no need to be profane. I may not be very orthodox in your sense of that, but I do feel that these matters ought to be discussed simply and seriously and reverently.
Yes, you know, this is so, I just have to mention this because I once in a sermon referred to something as damned nonsense. You know, and I meant it. But we are so accustomed to thinking that any use of the word hell and damn is somehow profanity, illegitimate, that when you do use them, you know, when you literally name something, it's not even taken seriously, or in fact it's offensive. After this sermon I had a woman come and say she was just terribly offended that now even clergy were using profanity in the pulpit. And I said, no, I meant it. It is damned nonsense. Oh, she said, I never thought of that. I was trying to teach my confirmation class one year that God damn is really a prayer. It is asking God to, and one little boy said, oh, is that wonderful? He said, I sure could pray that a lot at home. Well, anyway, we call it hell. There's no need to be profane. Marvelous. Lewis just gets to discuss hell reverently. I meant what I said. You have been in hell, though if you don't go back, you may call it purgatory.
Go on, my dear boy, go on. That is so like you. No doubt you'll tell me why, on your view, I was sent there. I'm not angry.
But don't you know? You went there because you are an apostate.
Are you serious, Dick?
Perfectly.
This is worse than I expected.
Do you really think people are penalized for their honest opinion, even assuming, for the sake of argument, that those opinions were mistaken?
Do you really think there are no sins of intellect?
There are indeed, Dick. There is hidebound prejudice and intellectual dishonesty and timidity and stagnation. But honest opinions fearlessly followed, they are not sins.
I know we used to talk that way. I did it too until the end of my life when I became what you call narrow. It all turns on what our honest opinion is.
Mine certainly were. They were not only honest, but heroic. I asserted them fearlessly. When the doctrine of the resurrection ceased to commend itself to the critical faculties which God had given me, I openly rejected it. I preached my famous sermon. I defied the whole chapter. I took every risk.
Now, he says, what risk? What was at all likely to come of it except what actually came? Popularity, sales for your book, invitations, and finally a bishopric.
Dick, this is unworthy of you. What are you suggesting?
Yeah, I keep thinking here that there was a time, you know, when if you said something that really was unorthodox, you paid for it dreadfully. Someone like Giordano Bruno, for example, who was burned in Rome, or Michael Servetus, who was burned in Geneva for denying the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus. Roland Bainton, I think, observed in one of his books that Servetus died saying, Jesus, Son of the Eternal God, have mercy on me. And if he had just put the adjective eternal in front of the Son instead of behind it, he wouldn't have been burned. You know, I mean, it was that kind of thing. And but today, you know, James Pike said all kinds of things that Lewis wasn't thinking of Pike at the time. Probably, if he has a model here, it's a Bishop Barnes of Birmingham in England, who in the 30s and 40s made a sort of game of denying every orthodox Christian notion he could deny. And Lewis is saying here, what did actually come? Popularity, sale for your books, invitations to speak, and finally a bishopric. Well, Dick, this is unworthy of you. You read that already. Friend, I'm not suggesting anything at all. You see, I know now, let us be frank, our opinions were not honestly come by. We simply found ourselves in contact with a certain current of ideas and plunged into it because it seemed modern and successful. At college, you know, we just started automatically writing the kind of essays that got good marks, saying the kind of things that won applause. When in our whole lives did we honestly face in solitude the one question on which all turned, whether after all the supernatural might not in fact occur? When did we put up one moment's real resistance to the loss of faith?
If this is meant to be a sketch of the genesis of liberal theology in general, I reply that it is a mere libel. Do you suggest that men like...
I have nothing to do with any generality, nor with any man but me and you. Oh, as you love your own soul, remember, you know that you and I were playing with loaded dice. We didn't want the other to be true. We were afraid of crude salvationism, afraid of a breach with the spirit of the age, afraid of ridicule, afraid above all of real spiritual fears and hopes.
I'm far from denying that young men may make mistakes. They may well be influenced by current fashions of thought. But it's not a question of how the opinions are formed. The point is that they were my honest opinions, sincerely expressed.
Of course. Having allowed oneself to drift, unresisting, unpraying, accepting every half-conscious solicitation from our desires, we reached a point where we no longer believed the faith. Just in the same way, a jealous man, drifting and unresisting, reaches a point where he believes lies about his best friend. A drunkard reaches a point at which, for the moment, he actually believes that another glass will do him no harm. The beliefs are sincere in the sense that they do occur as psychological events in the man's mind. If that's what you mean by sincerity, they are sincere, and so were ours. But errors which are sincere in that sense are not innocent.
You'll be justifying the Inquisition in a moment.
Why? Because the Middle Ages erred in one direction, does it follow that there is no error in the opposite direction?
Well, this is extremely interesting. It's a point of view. Certainly it's a point of view. In the meantime...
There is no meantime. All that is over. We are not playing now. I have been talking of the past, your past and mine, only in order that you may turn from it forever. One wrench and the tooth will be out. You can begin as if nothing had ever gone wrong. White as snow. It's all true, you know. He is in me for you with that power. And I have come a long journey to meet you. You have seen hell. You are in sight of heaven. Will you even now repent and believe?
I'm not sure that I've got the exact point you are trying to make.
I'm not trying to make any point. I'm telling you to repent and believe.
But, my dear boy, I believe already. We may not be perfectly agreed, but you have completely misjudged me if you do not realize that my religion is very real and a very precious thing to me.
You know, I hope you notice what is going on here. He is, in a sense, saying that there is such a thing as theological error, that there is, in fact, heresy, that there can be false teaching and false faith. It's one of the most pervasive notions in America, that everybody just sort of ought to all believe whatever they want to as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. And one of the things we are most hesitant to do is to say something is wrong. And especially after the Missouri Synod episode and all the publicity that got, you'd always say, oh, the last thing we want is anybody to say heresy. And here Lewis is suggesting that is perhaps exactly what we ought to say. My religion is a very real and very precious thing to me, says this man. And Lewis's reply, or whoever it is, very well. Will you believe in me?
In what sense?
Will you come with me to the mountains? It will hurt at first until your feet are hardened. Reality is harsh to the feet of shadows. But will you come?
Well, it's a plan. I'm perfectly ready to consider it. Of course, I should require some assurances. I should want a guarantee that you are taking me to a place where I shall find a wider sphere of usefulness and scope of talent.
It's a devastating clergy phrase. Go on.
And an atmosphere of free inquiry. In short, all that one means by civilization and or the spiritual life.
No. I can promise you none of these things. No sphere of usefulness, you are not needed there at all. No scope for your talents, only forgiveness for having perverted them. No atmosphere of inquiry, for I will bring you to the land not of questions but of answers, and you shall see the face of God.
Ah, but we must all interpret those beautiful words in our own way. For me, there is no such thing as a final answer. The free-winded inquiry must always continue to blow through the mind, must it not? Prove all things. To travel hopefully is better than to arrive.
If that were true, and known to be true, how could anyone travel hopefully? There would be nothing to hope for.
But you must feel yourself that there is something stifling about the idea of finality. Stagnation, my dear boy, what is more soul-destroying than stagnation?
Well, on that question, we're going to have to quit today. We'll pick this up tomorrow and then make it the basis.